Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of Special Collections here in the MSU Libraries, and I'd like to welcome all of you to another evening of the Michigan Writer Series. Indeed, this is another season of the Michigan Writer Series, so we're delighted that you all could make it here. The intent of the Writer Series is to bring Michigan writers to campus where our audiences can listen to them, meet them, see them, and after the readings, ask questions of them if they so desire. As with all events at the Michigan Writer Series, it is recorded, it is put on the internet, so if there's a time and place in the future that you want to relive this moment, you can certainly tune in to the webpage that we offer on our sheet here that also offers our upcoming visitors for the Michigan Writer Series, and you can tune in and listen to Mr. Baxter read again and relive the event on our webpage. I'm very delighted that Mr. Baxter is here tonight with us, Charles Baxter, a writer from Ann Arbor, Michigan. And to introduce Mr. Baxter is the writer-in-residence and distinguished professor of English here at MSU, Diane Wachowski. Diane?
Is this an amplifying mic or just a... Okay. And you can hear me. Charles Baxter has often been called a writer's writer. This is always meant as a compliment, testifying to his beautiful craftsmanship, the complexity of his ideas, and the richness of the characters that unwind his narratives. However, in this difficult time of dictated political correctness surrounding art, it also seems like an indirect insult, implying that perhaps only other writers would care to read his work. That is so far from the reality of Charles Baxter's fiction as to render the whole allegation foolish. Charles Baxter is a writer for everyone who can read, who cares for people, the problems of contemporary American society, and certainly for anyone who likes a good story. Perhaps with Oprah's inadvertent glorification of traditional humanistic fiction in her infamous tangle with novelist Jonathan Franzen, the bestseller list is once again seeing novelists like Richard Russo rather than just the Danielle Steeles, the Tom Clancys, John Grishams, and Nora Robertses. I've heard that Charlie's most recent novel, Feast of Love, has been sold to the movies, so perhaps next year we'll find another high-quality piece of fiction on the bestseller list, and this time with the Baxter name attached to it. Already, Charles Baxter's novels and short stories of the closely observed life have a very wide range of fans, and there are many reasons to love his life as well as his work. He began his publishing career with two volumes of poetry, Chameleon in 1970 and The South Dakota Guidebook in 1974. To me, an illustration of what I preach, that learning the craft of poetry makes you a more meticulous prose writer. However, around 1976, he began to have what another critic has called, quote, a crisis with poetry, unquote. Don Lee quotes Charles Baxter in his Plowshares profile saying, "I spent an entire summer trying to write poetry and failing at it. It was as if the knowledge of how to do it had somehow left me, and I found myself ill-equipped to write. I was becoming more interested in sequences, characters, and characterizations, the rickrack of details surrounding people." On the other hand, perhaps his beginnings as a poet are phenomenal rather than exemplary. In fact, many other aspects of Charles Baxter are rare and unusual. He earned a PhD in literature, a discipline few writers can survive. He's also one of the few people in the world who have found being rich uncomfortable when, as a teenager, his widowed mother married a very wealthy man and moved him and his brother into a mansion. He says that his only goal was, quote, to get out, unquote. Like the characters in his stories, Charles Baxter is someone who transcends daily life while yet living it very well. He's one of the easiest people to talk to, one of the most connected and grounded. It might be old-fashioned to say this, but the fiction of Charles Baxter shows us that even in the most difficult and complex situations, we have choices and we can make them with integrity. His work is filled with compassion, it's gentle and somewhat humorous, and as one of his titles indicates, it's always filled with the possibility of light. Coming from Minnesota, where he was educated at McAllister College, he went to Buffalo for his graduate work and wound up teaching at Wayne State University for many years. During that time, he and his wife and son lived in Ann Arbor. And eventually, the University of Michigan realized they were missing a good thing and invited him to join their graduate faculty in creative writing. He is the author of 3 novels and 4 collections of short stories, as well as a book of essays and 3 books of poetry. We are very lucky to have a writer of his caliber living in our neighborhood, though I think the news is that he and his wife are moving back to the Twin Cities next year. But for now, we are so glad to have you still with us tonight, Charles Baxter.
Thank you, Diane. And thank you all for turning out on a Friday night. Can you all hear me? It's a little mysterious about, yes? All right. Apparently, I'm free to move behind this podium, but I won't move all that much. I thought that what I would do tonight is to read for about 40 minutes, and I'll read a selection from the Feast of Love for 20 minutes, and then I'm going to read a piece from my new book, Saul and Patsy, which will be out next year. It's a section that I have never read aloud to anybody. I think a total of 3 or 4 people have seen it, so I'm scared, but I want to read it anyway. The section from the Feast of Love that I'm going to read to you is chapter 9, and it is narrated by a guy named Bradley, who works at the mall at a coffee shop called Jitters. He's the manager. And in this chapter, Bradley has had a breakup with his first wife, Catherine. And so he's been feeling very gloomy, and I won't say depressed. Depressed is not a word I like. Woebegone is not very good either. But he's one of those guys who has a lot of trouble getting up on Monday morning and going to work. And so this chapter is a little bit about that. It is also about my wish to get an American shopping mall into fiction. And since I'm a Midwesterner, a tornado. And I thought that in this chapter, I could probably get a tornado and a shopping mall into the same chapter by having the tornado hit the shopping mall, as you will see. The other thing that actually got the story started is that my wife and I, Martha and I, drive north up to the north shore of Lake Superior through the UP. And if you do drives like that, you'll notice along I-75, and then actually if you drive across the UP, you'll notice this everywhere. People have put up plastic crosses everywhere. There's been a fatality. And often near the cross, there are plastic flowers. And the cross has the name of the person who died on it. I noticed this about 4 or 5 years ago. These things are turning up in Ann Arbor, too. So that made its way into the chapter. So this is chapter 9, and it's Bradley speaking. He's a kind of querulous guy. I can't quite do his voice, but I'll do my best. The one thing you have to remember is that his first wife has just left him. Sometimes I feel as if my life is a murder mystery, only I haven't been murdered yet, and I don't plan on being murdered at all, of course, but it's puzzling, my life, I mean, the way a murder mystery is puzzling, the way with something missing or dead out there where everyone can see it, what happened to Bradley W. Smith, only I don't know what it is, just this intimation of violence. I need a detective who could snoop around in my life and then tell me the solution to the mystery that I have yet to define and the crime that created it. For example, driving turbo my car on the 15-minute commute to Jitters, I go around three curves. On two of these curves, somebody has planted little white wooden crosses to memorialize sudden vehicular deaths. And next to each cross, a display of artificial flowers. Artificial flowers. Petunias, these are, and violets, probably. Weeks pass, they don't fade. I wait for them to droop, as in a natural cycle, but they're stubbornly unalive and therefore unwielding, so they must be plastic with machine-made blues and yellows and whites. Imagine that. Plastic, flower, sorrow. The quality of the grief has a kind of discount aura, like a relic tossed haphazardly into a bin. I just mark it down and store it away every morning. I notice these things for my own protection. It's a short drive that I have to do every dawn of the working week, and there are few signs of violence on it except for these crosses. I drive with one hand on the wheel, holding my cup containing coffee mixed with vanilla and chocolate chip ice cream. In my other hand, I pass by the health club. The manager is often outside, enjoying a cigarette. Several months ago, on one of our Sunday morning phone calls, when I asked my dad whether he had any trouble rising and shining at daybreak, or getting motivated for his job at the agency, he became exasperated with me. He said, "Son, Monday morning is Monday morning. Everybody's got to do it. There are no solutions. There's only the work." My father, a gentle man, becomes abrasive on long distance. "Brad, you want food on the table. You have to go to the job like everyone else," he said, as if this thought had not already occurred to me. "I was just asking," I said. "My poor old dad, liver spots, 7 years from retirement, quadruple bypass, still overweight, a weekly participant at AA meetings. He's got little scabs on his scalp, I don't know from what. I imagined him standing there by the phone, a graying, pudgy Vietnam War survivor trying to offer sage-sounding advice to his son, me." "Nobody likes a whiner," he said. "What brought this up?" He didn't wait for an answer. "A man's got to show up at the place where they expect you to show up." He coughed and hawked phlegm into the mouthpiece, or so it sounded. "You have a good job. But since you want advice, I'll tell you something to keep your spirits elevated. I just recalled this, something your grandfather once told me. This was his cure for low spirits. When you pour your first cup of coffee of the day, if you're feeling crummy, put a dab of ice cream into it. It's festive. Then you got to trudge off like everybody else, like I said, but you've got the ice cream with you. Forget art. Put your trust in ice cream." Booze once, ice cream now, I thought, Jesus, the poor guy, I should be the one giving him consolation and advice. "No," I said, "Dad, it's just, you know, with my marriage breaking up." "Listen, Brad," he said, "don't tell me, I can't. I don't know, you're way past the age when your parents tell you much of anything. It's just what? My father worries about long distance costs almost as much as he worries about me, and sometimes is short in these conversations. Really, he means well. I'm not presenting his best side here. "You don't like your job managing that coffee store? Then get another position," he said. He waited, and his voice grew a bit quieter. "Son, believe me, I blow some of my brains out at work every day. My head's full of bullet holes. It's what work does to you. Life is suffering, as the major religions say. Face up to facts." "Well," I said, "as long as we're on this subject of advice and everything, how have you managed to stay married to Mom for so long? What is it, 30?
38 years.
38 years, I said. How'd you manage that?"
"That's no sort of question," he said. "You can't ask me that. But since you've asked, I'll answer it. It's simple. You want to know the secret? I'll tell you what the secret is. Here's the secret. I kept my mouth shut. He waited, a wintry pause. That's the secret. I arrive at the mall and park my car, check the sky for rain or snow. On this particular morning, the sky has a weird pink cellophane-like tint to it. The air smells like factory exhaust. I walk in through one of the service entrances. I am a service person. When I go into the back entrance of our business, I smell the beans and the roasters and the antiseptic lacquered with fruit smell of floor cleanser, and then even more faintly the strange, bleary artificiality of the air, characteristic of enclosed shopping malls. The ion content in the oxygen has been tampered with by people trying to save money, by giving you less oxygen to breathe. You get lightheaded and desperate to shop. The air smells machine manufactured, and the light looks manufactured or maybe recycled from previous light. Above us in the mall's atrium, close to our entrance, is a skylight in a mystical geometrical shape like one of those Masonic emblems. Don't get me wrong, I believe in business and profit, only... Anyway, across from us is a clothes store, Snooker, specializing in clothes with a slick polyester thug appeal, and next to it, on one side is Video Village, and on the other side is All Outdoors, where they sell what they call wilderness products, though there's no wilderness within 1,000 miles of here. Hiking clothes and such, along with alpha wave sound effect tapes of breakers crashing on the beach and nearly extinct birds singing their farewell songs. The place smells of cedar and burlap. Nearer to us, down a sort of mall alleyway heading out to the north entrance, there's a cinnamon roll concession and a one-hour photo lab and a fun factory and a maternity store called Motherhood. Next to a nutrition store for bodybuilders, they sell mega vitamins, protein powders, and motivation magazines and tapes in there. The last store in that alley is accessories, everything extreme you want. Out on the courtyard is a salad and snack store, the Marquis de Salade. Next to our business is Heppelworth's, which sells weekly, monthly, and yearly planners, and motivation posters, and motivation books. They sell motivation in there, preachers of aggression, hard sell cures for Monday morning blues. Motivation. Almost everyone at our end of the mall sells motivation, except us. Well, I guess we do that too, with our coffee. Following Catherine's departure from my life, I'd go to work after giving Brad, he has a dog named after himself, Bradley, it's Bradley the dog. I'd go to work after giving Bradley the dog his early morning walk. I have to admit it, the business gave me a boost. I liked having a place to go in the morning. I liked having a purpose. I liked arriving there before the mall had opened. It's what I guess you'd call a dawn feeling. No doubt there's a word for this in German. Every day is a new day when filled with the dawn feeling, a virgin day until it gets fucked up by human activity and becomes history. I'd look out through the steel mesh security curtains at the dim interior spaces of the Briardale Mall. I'd sit down and inspect the books and spreadsheets, then make sure the cups and saucers and equipment were all in place. I'd make the brews for the day and load the dispenser thermoses with them. I'd open the cash register and do a count. I'd page through specialty coffee retailer. I'd look out through those cell bars at the empty mall. Shiny surfaces. Every surface washed and polished. After an hour or so, the bakery would deliver our breads and pastries for the day. And I'd chat with the delivery guy, Hans. When the exterior doors of the mall open, the senior citizens arrive and start their mall walking. Smelling of antique cologne, they hold their elbows up and appear to be quite
complacent as they grind by. Chloe comes in right about then. Chloe, who works here at Jitters, because she says there's a harmonic convergence right in this very spot in the mall. She says it's a sacred place, like Sedona, Arizona. Sweet girl that she is, Chloe gives my nerves a good shaking every day. Sometimes she comes in so yeasty with sex she's just had with Oscar that I feel like applauding. She gives off sexual odors like a flower in the front yard trying to make a statement about gardens, which of course flowers don't need to do. Her shirt says raging hormones across the front. She's in love with Oscar now. It's gone beyond sex. And Oscar has told her, after consulting with me, should he tell her, that he's in love with her. They look so punk and disreputable, those two, but they're just a couple of kids dressed and costumed to affect a menacing appearance. So on this particular day, she comes in and she says, "So how's it going, Mr. S?" "Oh, okay," I tell her. "The usual Monday, you know. I kept noticing those crosses on the way here." "Monday," she exclaims. "Right. And those crosses. Now, I ever tell you I once went to school with one of the guys who got one of those crosses? He was a total asshole. He wasn't even a fun asshole, which, you know, some of them are. Even dead, he's lucky to get a cross. I'm sorry, I wouldn't have given that guy a shave." "What was his name?" I asked. "Bumford," she says. "Bumford McGonaghy, a loser with a loser name. Those crosses cry my eyes out. He was a mean guy. Guess I should have more sympathy, huh?" She puts on her apron and starts arranging the pastries like an art project. "How's Oscar?" I ask. "What time is he coming in?" "Oh, you should know that," she says. "I'm just labor, you're management." She smiles and then she stops to think. "Around 1. She stands up straight. "No, 1:30. We have overhead track lighting, 5 lights over the service area, and Chloe has a habit of moving back and forth behind the counter so that she appears sequentially under the lights like an actress on a stage. She's careful not to plant herself in the small, shadowy, vacant gaps between the lights. She's star practicing. She flicks her head to highlight her hair. She'd be breaking my heart if she weren't my employee and a kid and Oscar's lover besides. You hear the weather report this morning, Mr. S?" I tell her I didn't. "Yeah, mucho thunderstorms, mucho kaboom, sky evil. Of course, who'd know in a mall?" "Yeah, who'd know," I agree. "Hey, what's the worst thing that ever happened to you?" "The worst thing?" I wait. "How come?" "Just curious." "Yeah, just curious." She gives me an odd square smile. "Huh," I say, "it's hard to decide. I can't think of it. Well, I'll tell you one thing. It isn't the worst. It's just that I remember something at this very moment. Here it is." I straighten up to scratch my eyebrows. "One time in college, a bunch of us somehow got cheap airplane tickets to Paris for a few days. We were hitchhiking once we got there. Anyhow, once you're in Paris, you go to the cathedral, Notre Dame. Big tourist attraction." She nods. "So, the 4 of us go to Notre Dame. And Notre Dame, you know, is actually a working cathedral. People, supplicants, I guess you'd call them, go in there and they pray. They have mass every morning despite all these tourists milling around." She stopped arranging the food and she looks up at me. "Well, we went in there. We started at the back. In the back of the cathedral, you can buy votive candles from some nun or other and light them for a loved one who needs help. And even if you're not Catholic, you can still do this. And because somebody I knew was sick, I bought a votive candle and lit it. I mean, a votive candle looks like a soul, doesn't it? And then I went over to put it on the stand."
"It's almost 9 o'clock, Mr. S."
"I know, we're almost ready. I got here early. Let me finish this story. I could see some customers outside our chain security gate waiting for their morning coffee fix. Well, we'd been traveling, so I was tired. So my hand was shaking, and these stands they have, they're thin and spindly,
like thin wrought iron and delicate because this is Europe. That's where we are. And because my hand was shaking, I reached down to the holder, this freestanding holder or candelabra or whatever, a votive candles, and somehow, I don't know how this happened, my hand caused this holder of candles, all these small flames, all these souls to fall over. And when it fell over, all the candles lit for the sake of a soul somewhere, there must have been 100 of them, all of them fell to the floor because of me, and all of them went out. And you know what the nun did, Chloe, the nun who was standing there? She spoke French. No, she could have, but she didn't. What she did was she screamed.
Wow.
Yeah, the nun screamed in my face. I felt like, you felt pretty bad, Mr. S. I can believe it. But you know, Mr. S., those were just candles. They weren't really souls. That's all superstition, that soul stuff. Oh, I know. No kidding, Mr. S. You shouldn't be so totally morbid. I thought when you were telling me about the worst thing you ever did, it would be like beating up a blind guy and stealing his car. No, I never did that. No. Oh, Oscar did once. You should get him to tell you about it. Okay. He was drunk, though. She prettily touches her perfect hair. And the guy wasn't really blind. He just said he was to take advantage of people. It was like a scam. Oscar saw through all that. It's 9 o'clock now, boss. We should open up. Right. And I unlock the curtain and touch a switch, and slowly the curtain rises on the working day. The candles are nothing to Chloe. They're just candles. I feel instantly better. Bless her. Around 11 o'clock, my next-door neighbor, Professor Harry Ginsberg, comes in. Mostly soaked, his remaining hair plastered to the sides of his face. He shakes out his umbrella, the one with the duck's head on it. He then waves at me, not to me, but at me, in greeting before he says, "Have you seen it outside, Bradley?" "Really, this is something you should see." He smiles and shakes his head, and raindrops drizzle off his face onto the floor. "What?" I say. "Skies," he says. "So dark, my boy, you can't read under them, and this in the daytime. Go look." All at once, there's a crack, like someone snapping a whip, and a low roaring, and a strange singeing smell coming from I don't know where, and Chloe, who's been bussing the tables with the collection tray, looks up.
"Didn't you hear?"
Harry asks me.
"They've been predicting tornadoes."
"There's no weather in malls, Harry," I tell him. "Not even tornadoes. We're impervious." Is that the word? "We're impervious to conditions." "I should have such optimism," Harry says, opening his mouth and laughing silently, a gesture I do not care for. "Impervious, impervious to conditions. An interesting phrase. I should have another roaring, longer this time, seems to be approaching us, silencing Harry's meditation on my wording. And when the storm sound starts to reverberate through the mall like the echo in a bowling alley, my customers hear it, and they all look up. And at this point, the lights blink, and the Oscar Peterson CD falls silent inside Jitters. And Mozart leaves his podium in the mall, and that's when I hear the shard crack sound of shattering glass. My God, Harry Ginsberg says. He takes his espresso to go and walks out to the atrium. At that point, the power fails in Briardale. The emergency lighting flickers on, battery-operated evacuation spots, and all but one of my customers get up and leave. Why should they leave? They're safe here. One woman near the entrance is drinking her cup of espresso and reading the New York Times, and she doesn't so much as budge, while everyone else scurries out. The light inside Jitters becomes emergency light, frosty and cold and glaring. But she just goes on reading, her head down, deep in concentration. Chloe joins me near the counter. "This is freakazoidal," she says. "What a rush." "Yeah," I agree. "Come on." We walk out toward the mall. You can hear the wind futilely attacking the mall's exterior, but you would need a full-scale level 5 tornado to blow this place apart, and so far we don't have that. From here, we can see into the depths of the mall. The cold emergency lights are giving all the merchandise a shakedown. The orphan shoes in the neighboring shoe store are like artifacts or clues to a crime. It's uniformly gray inside the mall now. What few customers there are seem to be distressed or disheartened. They're limping along without purpose. It's as if when you turn the power off, the merchandise somehow becomes nothing but a ruin. People lose the desire to buy. Their hearts go out of it. Why is the light given, you ask? Why is the light taken away? Down at the center of the mall, the fountain has stopped surging into the deionized air, and the water sits there gathering dust. Here and there in the far recesses of the mall, the customers move around, totally unmotivated, confused and abandoned, quite completely Monday morning, and everything we've got here for sale loses its allure. Nothing here but wallflower commodities, spinster products. Two old people, arm in arm, help each other walk toward the exit. Across the acres of merchandise, a vast silence prevails. "Wow, this is amazing," Chloe says, and I nod in agreement. "You know what this makes me think of?" "What?" "Well, your candle's going out." She smiles at me, and one of her blonde eyebrows lifts as she thinks of what to say next. But she doesn't say anything, eloquently sexy in her silence. "Hmm," I say, pretending to think this over. But actually, I am thinking this over. Chloe and I go back into jitters. She ambles toward the back, taking off her apron, swaying as she goes. She sits down in a sort of wing chair back near the restroom and seems to doze off. Oscar keeps her busy at night. I'll wake her up when the customers return. I'm a demanding boss, but a fair one. Then two things happen. I go up to the woman who's been sitting at a small table near the front, reading the New York Times, and I say to her, "How can you read in this light? It's so dim." "Oh, I'm used to dim bulbs," she says. "Oh, in that case, you'd be right at home here," I tell her. She seems startled by my witticism and smiles at me, and in the dim light, I can see that her eyes are blue. We introduce ourselves eventually, and I find out that her name is Diana. Not to get ahead of myself here, but she becomes my second wife. The other thing that happens before the lights go back on in the mall is that a strange little man with greasy hair appears outside what I guess you'd call our doorway. He stands there and stands there, shifting from one foot to the other. He's not large, but he looks strong and wiry, and when I first see him, I get the impression that he's not really looking over the brioche. He's searching for someone, and then he finds what he's searching for, which is Chloe. Even though she's at the back taking a cat nap, he's staring at her. "May I help you?" I ask him to fill the time. He shakes his head. From where I'm standing, I can smell the whiskey on his breath. I can tell it's a cheap whiskey, a Canadian blend, the worst of all possible whiskeys. The next time I look over in his direction, he's vanished. Right at 1 o'clock on the dot, Oscar swaggers into jitters. After soul kissing him, Chloe tells Oscar about this. The man who has appeared is called the Bat, and he's Oscar's father. All Oscar says is, "Dumb old man," and then he puts his apron on. But I'm not really thinking about them, because I'm thinking about Diana, having already obtained her phone number. I took courage because she hadn't been demeaned as yet with someone else's engagement or wedding ring. I loved it, how she could sit there, sit still, unaffected by storms and power failures. Before the lights came back on in the mall,
I was thinking of eating supper with this woman, this Diana, whose blue eyes and stay-puttedness in the midst of storm and rack had banished from my mind all thought of eulogies and votive candles and little white crosses accompanied by plastic flowers that poked up through the dirt and unfolded their zombie blossoms on a cheerless Monday morning. So that's what I'm going to read from the Feast of Love. Now, the part I have never read to anybody. This is chapter 12 from my new book. And you know how people, when they read from the middle of a novel, always start out by saying, well, here's what you have to know. I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to start reading. Chapter 12. A squirrel squatted in the birdbath. Another squirrel was hanging by its claws onto the bird feeder. The girl, looking out her bedroom window at the backyard, cleaned her fingernails half-heartedly with the metal nail file and thought of the end of the world that didn't happen on January 1st, 2000, and the one that did happen 21 months later. And then she wondered why, if there was a word ruthless that was applied to enemies of the USA, then what happened to its opposite, its lost positive ruth, which would have to mean kindness, but didn't mean anything because nobody used it. We had ruthless enemies, but no ruth friends. If some people were unruly, then who was ruly? Nobody. When her room was messy, her mother said it was unkempt. But when it was clean, it was never kempt, because the word didn't exist. Everybody had a word from the wrong thing, but silence prevailed for the right. When her room was clean, it wasn't anything you could put it in, you could put into words. It was wordless. Early in the morning, just after the sun was up, the squirrels looked like boys somehow. She couldn't say why. Maybe because of the way they moved, skittering and chasing each other, twitching, or maybe it was the fur, something. Her name was Gina. She was 16 years old, and it was Sunday, family day. After staring at the squirrels, she remembered to feed her guinea pig his breakfast food pellets. Wilbur squeaked and squealed softly as she dropped the pellets down the cage bars into the red plastic tray. It didn't take much to make him happy. On the other side of her room was a picture of Switzerland her mom had put up years ago. The picture had a lake on it, which was ruthlessly blue. Gina felt something funny when she looked at this picture, so she didn't look at it very often. She couldn't take it down because her mom had given it to her. Family day. The plan was her dad would show up and take them, her brother, her mom, herself, to the beach. Gina threw on a t-shirt and a pair of jeans. She grabbed her flute and went into the basement to practice. She was in the school marching band. 10 minutes later, she heard the thud of the morning newspaper flung against the front screen door. She put her flute on top of her dad's workbench and went upstairs to read the headlines. There was something about Iraq, bombs, something about Cuba, the blockade, and something about Ireland, more bombs, and something about Gordy Himmelman. Gordy Himmelman, he had shot himself to death. It was permanent. Why hadn't anybody called her about it? She had been in classes with Gordy Himmelman since kindergarten, but he was in a class by himself, and she hadn't seen much of him since he had dropped out. He muttered and swore and blew his nose on notebook paper, and he talked to himself in long strings of garble and never had any friends you could show in public. You could feel sorry for him, but he would never notice how sorry you felt, and he wouldn't care. Pity was lost on him. It was a total waste of time. In third grade, he had brought a penlight battery into school, and standing next to the monkey bars, he had swallowed it during recess. It was only a double A, but even so. He had black and blue marks all over him most days. His breath smelled of dill pickles that had gone unfresh.
You couldn't even talk to him about the weather because he never noticed it. Didn't make any difference to him what the sky was doing or how it was doing it. He had this sort of human junkyard, don't mess with me look on his face and would kick anyone who got in his way, though he did have one comic routine, slugging himself in the face so hard that his head jerked backward. He had bicycled to that teacher, Mr. Bernstein's house, where he had blown his brains out in the yard in front of the tree in the morning. It was a matinee suicide. There was a picture of the tree on the front page of the paper. It was a color picture, and you could sort of see the blood if you looked hard. It hadn't been a suicide note. Suicide note would have been like a writing assignment, way too hard. Gina felt something stirring inside her. She was kind of interested in death. Gordy was the first person she'd ever known who had entered it. He had gone from being Mr. Nothing to being Mr. Something else, a temporarily interesting person. She sat at the kitchen counter eating her strawberry Pop-Tart, wondering whether Gordy was lying on a bed surrounded by virgins or eternal fire or what. It was sort of cool, him doing that. It was like the smartest thing he'd ever done. Adventuresome and courageous. If you didn't have a life, maybe you got one by being dead. Her dad was late. Finally, he showed up at 11:30 in his red Durango saying, "Ha ha, I'm late." He and Gina's mom were divorced, but they were still friends, and her dad had never really committed himself to the divorce, in Gina's opinion. He was half-hearted about it, a romantic sad sack. They had cooked up this family day thing 2 years ago. Every weekend, he'd come to pick up Gina and Bertie, her little brother, and her mom. Gina envied most divorced kids who went from their moms to their dads without the cheesiness of family day. And then they'd do bowling-type activities for the sake of togetherness and friendliness, which, of course, was a total fraud since they weren't together or friendly at all. In the car, Gina studied her father's face. She had wanted to drive, but no one trusted her behind the wheel yet. For once, she had been allowed to sit up front, semi-adult, now that she had filled out and like that. So they gave her front seat privileges sometimes, occasional woman privileges. Her mom and Bertie were in the back, Bertie playing with his Game Boy, her mom with her earphones on, listening to music so she wouldn't have to listen to the plinks and plunks of the Game Boy or talk to her ex, Gina's dad, the driver, half committed to his divorce, an undecided single man driving the car. He would commit to the divorce when he found a girlfriend he really liked, which he hadn't yet. Gina had met one of the girlfriends whom he had only sort of liked, a woman who tried way too hard to be nice and looked like a minor character in a soap opera. Gina had mentioned Gordy Himmelman to her dad, and her dad had said, "Yeah, it was way too bad." She was interested in her father's face. Because it was her father's, she didn't know if he was handsome or what. You couldn't always tell when they were your parents, though with her friend Gretchen Mullen, you certainly could, since Gretchen's father looked like a hobgoblin. At first, she thought her own father had a sort of no-brand Walmart standard-issue father face. Now, she wasn't so sure. He was possibly handsome. There was no way of knowing. Her dad was a master plumber. Therefore, his hands often had cuts or grease under the fingernails. Very large hands made big by genetic fate. His hair was short and brown, cut so it bristled, and near his temples you could see a change in color, salty. On his right cheek, her dad had a crease, as if his skin had been cut by a knife or a sharp piece of paper. But it was only a wrinkle getting started, the first canal in a network of creases to come, his face slowly but surely turning into Mars, the red planet. His teeth were very white and even, the most rock star thing about him. His eyes were brown and spaced wide apart, not narrow the way teenage boys' eyes are usually narrow, and they drilled into you so that sometimes you had to turn away so you wouldn't be injured by the father look. Her father's beard line was so distinct and straight, it looked put in with a ruler and was so heavy that even if he shaved in the morning, he usually needed another shave around dinner time. His breath smelled of cigarettes, which he smoked in private. You couldn't find the boy in there anymore. It wasn't there. He was growing a belly from the beer he drank, at night and weekends, and most of the time he seemed comfortable with it, though it seemed to tire him out too. He didn't smile much, and only when he had to. He had once told Gina, "Life is serious." He looked like a plumber on a TV show who comes in halfway through the program and who someone, though not the main character, falls in love with because he's so manly and can fix things. Sometimes at a stoplight or when he saw a car pull in front of him, her dad's face changed out of its TV expression. Suddenly, he grimaced like someone had started to do surgery on him right over his heart. And he was pretending that nothing was happening to him, even though his chest was being opened, bared to fresh air. And that expression vanished like it had never been there. What was that about? His pain, his secret squirrel life, probably. Still, there was no point in talking to him about Gordy Himmelman. At the lake, they settled on their beach towels. Birdie, who was oblivious to everything, went on playing with his Game Boy. Gina's mom stretched out on her back in an effort to douse herself with lethal tanning rays. Her dad carried the picnic basket into the shade and started to read his copy of Car and Driver. Gina went to the concession stand to get herself an ice cream cone, which she would buy with her own money. The stand had been constructed out of concrete blocks, painted white, covered overhead by a cheap corrugated roof. Under it, everything seemed to be sunbaking. Behind the counter was a popcorn machine with a high-intensity yellow heat lamp shining on the pop kernels in their little glass house, making them look radioactive. The sidewalk leading up to and away from the stand, stained with the residue of spilled pink ice cream and ketchup, felt sticky under Gina's feet. The kid who was working at the stand selling snack food and renting canoes was a boy she didn't recognize, about her age, maybe a year or two older, with short orange hair and an earring, and he stood behind the counter next to the candy bar display, staring with pain and boredom at the floor. He was experiencing summer job agony. He had a rock station blaring from his battery-operated radio perched on top of the freezer, and his body twitched quietly to the beat. When Gina appeared, the boy looked at her with relief, relief followed by recognition and sympathy followed by a leer as he checked out her tits, the leer followed by a friendly smirk. It all happened very fast. He was like other boys. They shifted gears so quickly you couldn't always follow them into those back roads and dense forests where they wanted to live with the other varmints and wolves. "Strawberry, please, single scoop," she asked. She smiled at him to tease him, to test out her power, to give him a hard-on tonight when he was in bed and couldn't sleep, thinking of her in the density of his empty, stupid life. Walking back to the sand and holding her ice cream cone, wearing her swimsuit in which Gina knew you could tell from a distance that she was almost a woman, she started to think about Gordy Himmelman. And when she did, and then looked at the crummy lake and the public beach with the algae floating in at 100 feet offshore, she felt weird and dizzy, as if what was the point? She kept walking and taking an occasional lick at the ice cream. There weren't too many people on the sand, but most of the men were fat, and their wives and girlfriends were fat too, and already they had started to yell at each other, even though it was barely lunchtime. She kept walking. It was something to do. Nobody here was beautiful. It all sucked. The lake gave her a funny feeling, just the fact that it was there. The sky was sky blue, and her mother said it was a perfect day, but if this was a perfect day, if this was the best God could manage with the available materials, then, well, no wonder Gordy Himmelman had shot himself, and no wonder her mother had put up that picture of Switzerland in her bedroom. Gina saw her whole sucky life stretched out in front of her, just like that, the 52 deck of cards with Family Day printed on one side, like the picture of the lake in Switzerland that she could barely stand to glance at, sucking her up. Why couldn't anything ever be perfect? It just wasn't possible. This wasn't perfect. It was its opposite, fecked. It was a totally fecked day. Just to the side, off on another beach towel, somebody's mom was yelling and slapping a little boy, slapping him, wham, 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 out in public and in front of everybody. And of course, the kid was screaming now, screaming, 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 screaming. Everybody having their own version of Family Day. Gina carried the ice cream cone to the water's edge. Right there, she saw herself in the algaed water, walking upside down, holding a raspberry ice cream cone, and next to her own water image, another water image, the sun this time. Gina walked into the water, out to where the algae dispersed, staring first at her diminishing reflection and then at the sun. It'd be interesting to get blind, she thought. People and dogs would take care of you and lead you through the rest of your life, forever. You'd be on a leash. The dog would make all the big decisions. Then she noticed that when she walked into the water, her images were sucked into it. As the water got deeper, there was less of you above it. It was like an instant diet. Okay, now that her legs were gone, you didn't have to look at her legs because they weren't there anymore. Well, they were underwater, but the water was so dirty she couldn't see them as well as she could see her reflection at the surface of her waist, her head, her chest, the ice cream cone. She wished she were prettier, movie pretty, but it was a kind of solution, walking into the water, watching your girl image get all swallowed up until there was no image, just the water. She held the ice cream cone above the water and then, after another lick, let it go as she went under. Under the water, she held her breath as long as she could, and then she thought of Gordy Himmelman, and sort of experimentally, she tried breathing in some water just to see what it was like, and she choked. She felt herself panicking and going up to the surface, but then she fought the panic when she imagined she saw somebody like Gordy Himmelman, though better looking, more like her dad, under the water with her, holding her hand and telling her it was better down here. And all the problems were solved. So she tried to relax and breathe in a little more water. There was panic, then some peace, and then panic. And then it was all right. And family day was finally over. And because she wasn't a very good swimmer anyway, she began to sink to the bottom, though there were all those annoying voices. She would miss Wilbur, her guinea pig, but not much else, not even the boys who had tried to feel her up. She drifted down and away. Her father and the lifeguard had seen the scoop of raspberry ice cream floating on the surface of the lake at the same time. They both rushed in, and Gina's dad reached her body first. He pulled her up, thrashed his way to the beach, and without thinking, he gave his daughter a Heimlich maneuver. Water erupted out of her mouth. Gina's eyes opened, and her father laid her down on the sand, and she said, "Gordy?" But what she said was garbled by the water still coming out of her lungs into her mouth and out of her mouth into the sand. As she came around, her hair falling around her eyes, she seemed disarrayed somehow, but pleased by all the fuss, and then she smiled because she had seen her father's face smeary with love. Thank you. Went a little longer than I had expected. I had never read that second piece before. Now, if there are questions, I'm happy to answer anything you have to ask. Yeah, back there. All right.
My name's Mike. I'm from Novi. I'm a Scorpio. When I was trying to figure out how I should develop a character, I was thinking you have to have background and you have to have motivation. Is there anything else that you would recommend?
The question is, when you're developing a character, you have to have motivation and background. Actually, my own feeling is that when you start writing a character, the one thing that you need to know more than anything else, and this also is an actor's question, because character and motivation are two of those things that actors think about when they're preparing a character. I always ask myself, and I always ask my students when they're stuck with a character, what does this person want, and what is this person afraid of? Those are the positive pole, that's the positive pole and the negative pole of the battery. What a character wants is what will send him or her forward towards something. And what a character is afraid of will send that character in reverse. I feel that that's more important to know than what the character looks like. You can sort of fill in the character's appearance as you go on, but if you don't know what the character wants, moving him or her forward and is afraid of, moving him or her backwards in a series of avoidance maneuvers, you won't be able to move the character at all. And then you'll just have, it will end up being a story about fate, things that happen to that character. So I always say when people get stuck with characters, just ask yourself, what does this person want? And if you don't know, give him something to want and get him moving. And then you'll start to have conflict because the conflict is, you know, two desires trying to occupy the same space at the same time. Good luck. Yes?
Do you ever feel like you're really writing a poem? For example, when you were describing the flowers, the plastic flowers on the roadside, or doing the catalog in the mall, do you feel like you're in the middle of the poem?
The question is, do I feel as if I'm writing a poem when I'm working on the prose? The prose that always interests me has some kind of lyrical, do you know what I mean? Some kind of lyrical energy to it. I don't just want to give information, I want to give it a kind of sound, a kind of voice, a sort of lyrical lift. I'm not writing a poem, strictly speaking, because those flowers are there. The plastic flowers and the mall material is there to reflect the way Bradley feels on that particular day. One of the questions that you can ask yourself is, if I'm writing this particular character, what will he or she see, given who he or she is? Now, Bradley, being who he is in that scene, is the kind of guy who, driving to work, is going to notice those plastic flowers by the side of the road and the plastic crosses. If he were in a good mood, he wouldn't notice them. So what I have to do as a writer is to put those crosses in the story and then give them some energy because that's what he's noticing. I give as many of the objects in a story all the energy I can because I think that American writers don't pay enough attention to objects. They take them for granted. They don't give life to the objects in their stories enough. So that's something I try to do, to make the world of objects in the story come alive. You may have noticed in the second piece I read to you, I spent a lot of time on that little popcorn stand at the beach. I just felt, who lately has described popcorn stands at public beaches in Michigan? Nobody I know. Has anybody described the way the light shines down on the popcorn in those little things? I mean, it does look kind of radioactive. And I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to give it a kind of energy. So, I mean, there's something else behind your question about whether I would sometimes find myself driven toward poetry, and I do, but this is sort of in the service of the story, what I'm describing to you. Yeah. In the 1940s, a wonderful writer named James Agee, in one of his essays, described expressive air pockets of dead silence. Now, fiction is a propulsive medium. If you're really reading a story, you're, you know, reading fast. But there are all of these moments in our lives where something happens and there's an expressive air pocket of dead silence. And what I try to do in my readings, even though I'm not thinking of this ahead of time, I try to stop here and there so that it's just that moment where something gets inflected because there's a little bit of silence on either side of it. You know what I mean? And in each reading, the silence drops in different places, depending on how I feel that night. But I try to put it there. The second piece I read to you is so new to me, I don't know where the silences are. So I was just ramming through it as quickly as I could. The next time I read it, I'll probably stop somewhere. But I think these expressive air pockets of dead silence are really important in dramatic writing. It's really important when people are talking to each other. It's really important when something serious is happening between two people in a dramatic situation and suddenly nobody is moving. And everybody's trying to decide what to do next. And it's our job to try to describe that moment when nothing is happening. And so, I mean, in a way, I'm taking your question. I'm going out from it. But it's sort of what your question leads to. Yes?
You mentioned your interest in describing objects. Do you have that same interest in describing place? Geographical place?
I guess I do. In part because I feel that these settings in the Midwest are just uncharted territory half the time. If you say Hollywood, everybody knows what it looks like. If you say the Hamptons or New York City or Cape Cod, everybody knows what you're talking about. Even if you're talking about the South. But if you're talking about a little public beach in Michigan, in the Irish Hills, nobody knows what you're talking about. Nobody knows what it looks like. Nobody knows what it looks like. So I've got a blank slate. And since these are the places where I have lived most of my adult life, and when my imagination is sort of daydreaming of places, these are the places I see. I love to get them down on paper. I almost feel like an explorer. You know, the lake I was describing in that chapter is a very particular lake in the Irish Hills. What? Which one?
Hay State Park,
where we used to spend a lot of time. And, you know, my wife and I and my son would go there and we would see parents hitting their kids sometimes. And you store all this stuff away, and eventually you use it. So yeah, the setting is very much a part of it.
Yeah, I must say, when the description of the lake, I thought of Lake Lance.
Never been there. Never been there. Any other questions? Yes. Oh, yeah. No, you fall in love with characters all the time. You fall in love with them. And when my first published novel, First Light, I went through a sort of male author's equivalent of separation anxiety when that book was done. I missed all the characters. And in The Feast of Love, I became so attached to Chloe that when her chapters were over, I really didn't want to go to another character. I wanted to stay with her. But you sort of have to learn to parcel out your feelings, you know, among all of these people. If you fall in love with one character too much, it'll show, and I think it will cripple the story. Writers have to be profligate with their feelings toward their characters. They have to love a lot of different characters, I think. Yes.
With that bit of a mention of September 11th in the second reading, we haven't read the book, we don't know anything about it, but has that affected you and your writing in some way, or was it just a passing note? It seemed like it must have affected something.
I was wondering if any, the question was, the September 11th was mentioned in the chapter, and has it affected me? I think it's affected everybody. And I think the question now for writers and thinkers and artists is how to have this history in our imaginations without seeming to exploit it. September 11th is very far, always in the background of this book, but
it's there. I mean, this book isn't going to come out until next year, so it's going to be 2 years away from that.
But I was writing this book. I came to this chapter a month or two after September 11th, and it fell in. And I thought, how do I use this in a way so that it doesn't seem to exploit a tragedy, so that it's there as a marker rather than anything else? I had a student through the MFA program at Warren Wilson who a couple of weeks after September 11th sent me a story about a building that had collapsed. And I had to write back to her and say, I understand why you wrote this story, but I don't think this is the way to do it. I think it has to be in the background. It has to be in the background, in the way that the rest of life serves, whatever is in your story is in the foreground, and if these materials are going to be there, they're somewhere in the background. That's not a good answer, but it's the only one I have. Yeah.
I noticed that in most of your work, there's quite a bit of humor, even in dark moments.
Yeah.
There's a lot of humor. But I wondered, when you wrote poetry, was your poetry as humorous?
No. My poetry was my poetry humorous? And I think it wasn't. I didn't find... whenever I wrote poetry, it became very solemn, which I think is a mistake. There should be a play of what used to be called wit and feeling in poetry, and it wasn't there. I found for myself, just as some people find poetry trying to find the right adjective, accommodating medium for them. So fiction was for me. I found that I could get more of myself into it, including the humor. And I think it's very hard and very unusual for a writer to write both poetry and fiction equally well. It's almost unknown for a writer to do both equally well. I think it's hard to love both of them equally. There are a few examples of people who have written both beautifully, but usually writers are better at one than the other.
This is sort of a follow-up question. We're talking about the importance of dramatic presentation
yeah.
in your fiction.
Mm-hmm. The trouble with my poetry was that I was always wanting to tell stories in it. And the The poems became longer and longer. They became more and more narrative. I was putting characters into the poems, and then I was giving the characters names, and I was thinking, you know, I want to describe how this character looks. Some poets can do that, but it generally is not the direction that the lyric gift takes you. It wasn't that I didn't write stories in my poems. If any of you find my book, Imaginary Paintings, I doubt that any of you will, it's very scarce. You'll find that there are, in fact, quite a few stories in the book, you know, two or three pages long with a lot of tableau effects. But I found that given what I was doing, it was better for me to write fiction. Also, I was reading a lot of poetry in those days and thinking, is this poetry? Why is this poetry? I don't understand. I should get out of doing this. I feel that writing poetry is actually a much more difficult art. To write a wonderful poem is almost an unimaginably difficult and wonderful achievement. And that my gifts, such as they were taking me in another direction. But I loved poetry. I still love it. It's just something I found I was not as able to do as this other thing. Another question before we conclude? No? Well, thank you all for coming. Thanks very much.